Welcome now to the midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland with two distinguished guests, and they are pianist Garrick Olson, whose music we have heard many times, and also the conductor Michael Stern. And both of them, welcome to the midday.
Thank you, Norman.
Wonderful to be here.
And nice to hear your voices, too. You're in town to perform with the Madison Symphony, and the three works on the program are, first of all, a work by Jonathan Leshnoff, and you're familiar with that composer, Michael.
Yes, he's a great friend of mine. He's been very prolific the last couple of decades, and I actually had the privilege to premiere this piece back in 2008. Jonathan he's a very, very interesting voice in American music, completely original voice, first of all, which I admire, because I think composers in this day and age should have something to say, and he certainly does. He writes music which is extremely, I think it's very honest. You know, it's there's no artifice to it. It's just well-crafted music with real musical intent and packs a punch. This is a short little piece that we're playing. It's called Rush. It's an overture of about 8 minutes. There are two little interludes in the middle which give us a moment of repose, but otherwise the piece reflects its title, which is this rush of adrenaline and momentum and excitement. It's kind of a perpetual motion kind of thing. But you know, with a lot of music, sometimes the multimeters, so changing of the order of the beats, doesn't seem to make any sense. And here it's all done so organically and so mindfully. The piece really works. It's just, it, you know, Jonathan is a person of great faith. A lot of the music he writes comes from his deep spirituality, which also is incredibly authentic. And this piece is not that. It's pure fun. And I thought, well, what a wonderful way to kick off a program.
With a piece like Rush, the way you describe it, Michael, I wonder, you know, the orchestra still has a little bit more work to do after that. It makes me wonder what kind of stamina they require, because you have Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5 on the program also.
And the Grieg Piano Concerto.
Yes.
Well, the Rush is only 8 minutes. I think a little, you know, a little focus, a little spinach before the concert, they'll be fine.
And speaking of the Grieg Piano Concerto, that is one of the 80 piano concertos that you have under your fingers, Garrick, or are there more now?
I suppose there are more. I don't really keep track, but, you know, sometimes too much is made of that. Yeah, sure, it's impressive, but there's this old thing about, you know, can they wake you up at 4 in the morning and ask you to play it, and do you know it? First of all, nobody wakes you up at 4 in the morning to play a concerto. And second of all, no, I mean, most of those 80 I could not play at a moment's notice. So let's...
That's all right, but I mean, we're talking about a...
So I have learned, yes, well, but, you know, some people can do that and some people can't, and everybody has different, I mean, there are great artists who have very limited repertories, and there are great artists who have very wide repertories, and vice versa. They're not so great, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you're selling yourself short. If I can just jump in here and say something about my friend Garrick, it's not the number of concerti or the amount of music that he plays which is impressive. It is the fact that in the immersion of that, he has such a comprehensive understanding. For instance, I don't know many other pianists, if any, who have played every note that Chopin ever wrote. And Chopin wrote a lot of piano music.
Kind of a specialist.
But it's not just that he plays, you know, my old teachers used to say, oh, a specialist is just somebody who repeats the same music a lot, and then people think it's great, even though he has no insight. Garrick has this monumental understanding of the totality of Chopin, so that when he plays something early or he plays something late, everything is in context, and his approach to the piano for a single piece is informed by his understanding of all the other pieces that he's played. That's what's impressive. So if he can play a Beethoven concerto or a Busoni concerto and everything in between, it's the way that he plays it, and I think he's selling himself a little short, because... And short is not a word I would ascribe to you.
No, well, thank you, Michael. I'll leave the room and you can say something nice about me now. I'm blushing a little bit. Well, thank you, yes. But I sometimes meant in the perhaps grade B film sense that sometimes right. too much can be made of it. I mean, here's another one. People often say, I can't believe you played, you know, memorized every sure. note of that Brahms concerto. And I say, well, that is not insignificant, but actually playing the Brahms concerto was way more difficult than learning all the notes of it.
Right.
So, because it's the physical ability to play it, and then, as Michael said, hopefully the musical and emotional understanding of what's going on in the music and your ability to project that. That takes, as my late great colleague Vladimir Horowitz said, it only takes a lifetime.
And so, I hope you have a long one.
Yes, well, one
we're
does.
We're working towards that.
We're trying, but yeah, it's a lot of yes. I've digested a lot of music, and it seems to. Thank you, I appreciate that. But on the subject of the Grieg Concerto, which is certainly an old favorite of everybody's, it was so popular. And perhaps overplayed that for a while during the lifetime of my career, it was severely underplayed. I recall when I played it with the Boston Symphony in about 1991 in subscription. It was the first time the Boston Symphony had done it in 47 years in subscription.
Wow.
They had done the first movement in Pops, which is a standard thing because it's kind of a nice little standalone piece. But I just want to say I love the piece. I grew up. It back in the days of LP records, it was always on the other side of the Schumann Concerto.
Right.
The adults in the room would say, well, the Schumann is a really great work, and the Grieg is nice. But, of course, when I was 10 or 11, I liked the Grieg more because it's more showy and flashy and noisy and obviously thrilling. Now I like them. But I do think it shouldn't be considered a hackneyed work. It's a masterpiece. And I think, Michael, unless I'm wrong, it's the prototype for the Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff endings. It got there first. By that I mean, in the middle of the last movement, which is lively, there's a lyric episode with a very touching, sweet theme. And then that comes back in triumph, you know, sort of, you know, all the ships coming back into the harbor, you know, and the sun is shining. But it has a Hollywood ending, in other words. And I think he was the first to do that. Tchaikovsky did it shortly afterwards, and Rachmaninoff made a specialty of it.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Let's see, Grieg was 1865.
Yeah.
He was all of 25 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And Tchaikovsky was just about 10 years later.
That's right. Yeah, so it's a bit pioneering that way, but that's not what makes it great. It's just in great in and of itself. And, of course, it was much admired by Liszt and other musicians. And I think it's so genuine and really, really touching. And I think only sometimes we experienced musicians have to get over the fact that, oh, yeah, that old thing, you know?
Well, yeah, speaking of old things, I think this is worth saying. There are certain pieces, absolute, undisputed masterpieces that have been pegged as, oh, these are good pieces for young people. They're almost student concerti. Let's say for the violinists, Viotti number 22 or the Seitz concerto. But the Mendelssohn concerto, the Bruch concerto, those violin concertos are played a lot by students, and some well, some not so well. And then you grow up and you have to play those pieces for real. The Grieg is a concerto like that. I've done the Grieg many times with younger pianists who were playing it for the first time. And then I've done it with mature, great artists who have come to live with this music for a long time. It's that shows the resilience of the piece, the worth of the piece as a masterpiece.
That it can hold up under all those circumstances.
Right.
Well, speaking of the aforementioned Chopin, let's have a mazurka or two from Garrick Olson.
Thank you.
I wish you could hear all the conversation too, but of course we have to include some music provided by my guest, one of my guests, Garrick Olson, also with me, Michael Stern, who is conducting the Madison Symphony this weekend in performances of Rush by Jonathan Leshnoff and also the Shostakovich Symphony No. 5 and Grieg's Piano Concerto in A Minor. Lots of conversation about what's difficult and what's not as difficult as it might seem to the non-performer. And I did want to get into one question for both of you, actually, but it would come from you first, Michael, and that is your father, Isaac Stern, is on record as having said that it's important to take risks for a performer. Where does that take us?
It... I mean, he was talking about transcending the idea that you prepare something as an instrumentalist and then you play it the same way all the time. And there is no way to make music compellingly unless you are in the moment. You can hear in other people's performances, even in your own performances, you can get totally hung up and a performance can get away from you if something happens and you are then back in that moment and you're not right there, or if you're anticipating something to come and you're glossing over where you are. Music is made in the moment, and it's made in a proactive sense and a reactive sense. So when you're playing with, for a solo pianist, it's maybe a little different, but not really in terms of what's going on in your head, but in terms of playing with an orchestra or in chamber music, it's a constant conversation. But the risk-taking comes from not having the notes, the practice, the rigor of the preparation top of mind. that all of that has to be subsumed. What has to be in the moment is this incredibly visceral and immediate connection between the notes. That's what he was talking about. And I must say, he was very good at that. And so a phrase could be, I mean, if you really want to clinically talk about analyzing it, some performances could be a little slower, a little faster. There would be a note that he would linger on. There would be something that happened, even in dynamics, that was in the moment, on the spot. But that kind of risk-taking could be a tempo that all of a sudden adrenaline gets you to play just a little faster, or to draw out something just a little more slowly so that the suspension of breath and of emotion takes you by surprise. A great performance should always somehow take one by surprise, even if it's exactly what you feels it. Being inevitable in a performance, which is very admirable, is not the same as doing what is routine or expected. That's the difference. And the risk that you take is to make the inevitability sound like you're playing it for the first time.
The illusion of the first time, they use that term in theater too. And I see the thumbs up from you, Garrick.
Well, he's a master.
You just said a lot of profound stuff, and it's absolutely true. In a way, we talk about multiple intelligences, and all the preparation and all the years of work and knowledge, that all has to go into your hard drive so that it cannot be forgotten. Right. And at the moment, you're actually just sort of making the music up as you do it, because you're not making it up because you're ignorant, though. You're making it up because you know it so well.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just seems like, oh, that just happened right now. Yeah, exactly.
My great teacher, Max Rudolph, used to get so frustrated when one of us, his students, or anybody, he would read, oh, you know, I know that Beethoven wrote this, or I know that Rachmaninoff wrote that, but I just feel it this way. And Rudolph would say, who the hell cares what you feel? Right? You have to serve the composer. But serving the composer is not some blind fealty to a way of playing that you have now made the only way for you to play. And the analogy of putting something in the hard drive is exactly what Rudolph was celebrating. You have all of that. In fact, the more you have of that, the freer you are to then go and make that in a living way come out differently every time.
But you have to do it as a soloist and an orchestra. So spontaneity, yes, but how does that play out, Garrick, if you're getting spontaneous and the orchestra has to stay with you?
On the very practical aspect, there are certain transitions and certain trap spots written into each piece by these great composers. And it's not that they write it. They want it to sound that way, but it's actually hard for us to do. So we have to come to some agreements, like right here. And the thing is, with an experienced and wonderful conductor like Michael, at certain transitions, we won't even talk about them. We'll just look at each other and we'll read each other's reaction in the rehearsal. And sometimes we don't have to talk about it, and sometimes we do have to talk about it, right, and say, oh, did you like that happened there? I thought that was nice. Well, I thought it dragged a little. I thought it pushed a little bit. But that's just business as usual. Rather, as you said, it's not doing something routine or rote or mechanical. Right. Yeah. So we're interacting all the time, and we're having a lot of musical conversation which doesn't involve words or looking at each other. People say to me often, you didn't look at the conductor much. I said, well, first of all, mostly you don't have to, but people don't realize that as I'm sitting there playing the piano, my eyes go to the left. You know, it's very shifty.
But the other thing is that the music is made on the breath,
yes,
right? So when you have somebody who's not breathing, it doesn't matter how technically proficient they are, it's just not going to work. But if somebody breathes, even on an instrument like the piano where you think, oh, you don't have to breathe, it's a mechanical thing, you push the key and that's nonsense, because great pianists have to breathe. Garrick breathes. You just listen to that Chopin that he played. It's a flawless expression of elegance, and elegance and lilt depend on breathing. Anyway, the whole orchestra has to breathe together. Every musician on stage, And, you know, the conductor's role is not to impose a way of doing something. It's to create a climate where everybody wants to play in the same way and to make something special happen. The only way to do that is to create a moment of breath where everybody is in with unanimity of purpose, absolutely focused on the same thing. And then anything that happens, if he goes a little faster, he goes a little slower, we take a little time. And plus, we know it's on the page. So you know that this beat, this bar has three beats and the next one has four beats. So there's that. But it's sometimes with some marvelous players, it's really difficult to follow them. And other people who take you mentioned Horowitz, or Rostropovich was the king of that, because he would take liberties. When I played with him, which I had the privilege of doing several times, there was never any issue of being together, because he was so clear in his breath of where he was going, even if it had absolutely no connection with what was printed on the page. There you go.
Very organic. Let's hear a bit more of Chopin. You've recorded every note that Chopin wrote, Garrick. You remember that one?
Well, very well. Yes, that's one of the posthumous etudes.
Yes,
which you didn't publish.
Yeah, which you recorded some time ago. What's your latest recording, by the way?
There hasn't been one for a while. Latest one is for reference recordings: complete Beethoven concertos with Donald Runicles.
Also,
and the Grand Teton Music Festival Orchestra, and that was done from live, of course, as all orchestral recordings are done mostly. And before that is Schubert's sonatas, the big A major and its little companion in A minor.
I will say our last recording with Kansas, not done live. We actually had a studio recording. It was just released a couple of months ago.
How unusual.
It was a really interesting recording of Brahms, music by Brahms for orchestra that was not written for orchestra by Brahms. So the Schoenberg transcription of the quartet,
oh, sure,
and the Virgil Thomson version of the chorale preludes, and a beautiful arrangement by Bright Chen of the Opus 118 intermezzo.
It's a fascinating exercise, isn't it?
Yeah. So it was. It's well, the orchestra sounds like gangbusters. It sounds great.